Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. How lucky do you feel? In 2007, the Bioinitiative Report, a collection of 14 papers by scientists across the globe, reported the following effects from exposures to wireless and cell phone technologies at our current level of exposures: DNA breaks and chromosome aberrations, cell death including death of brain neurons, increased free radical production, cell stress and premature aging, changes in brain function including memory loss, retarded learning, performance impairment in children, headaches and fatigue, sleep disorders, neurodegenerative conditions, reduction in melatonin secretion, and cancers. Why isn't this splashed across the newspapers? Oh, come on, you know why. Annualized wireless revenues in 2008 will reach $144 billion, and U.S. spending on wireless communications will reach $212 billion by this year. Based on the current 15% annual growth rate, in the next 5 years, wireless will become a larger sector of the U.S. economy than both agriculture and cars. Still dubious? Researcher Dr. Leonard Hardell reported that after even just one or more years of use, there is a five-point-two elevated risk in children who began using cell phones before the age of 20 years. That means children will have five times more risk of getting cancer by the time they hit 20. How lucky do you feel? Stay tuned for an update on the news that never hits the news outlets. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. The White House convened its forum on health care reform last week. Advocates for a single-payer health care system were conspicuously absent because they were conspicuously not invited. This despite a bill before Congress with over 90 co-sponsors that would create just such a system. The bill is H.R. 676, the so-called Medicare for All Act, authored by John Conyers and Dennis Kucinich. Neither author nor any of the co-sponsors was invited to the forum, even when they asked. Nor were representatives from organizations such as Physicians for a National Health Program that advocate single-payer. Instead, we were told that single-payer is off the table by President Obama and congressional leaders, in particular Senator Max Baucus, chair of the Senate Finance Committee and the apparent gatekeeper on this issue. I believe it's time that we citizens not only put single-payer back on the table, but get up on the table with it and stay there until people like Senator Max Baucus stop clinging to the corpse that is our current medical insurance system. No doubt timed to coincide with the White House Forum on Healthcare Reform, the Business Roundtable released what should have been a very disturbing report. As I'm sure you're all aware, the U.S. spends more money on medical care per person than any industrialized country. The Business Roundtable went a step further and systematically compared the U.S. to the G5 nations, Canada, France, Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom, and to the top three industrializing nations, Brazil, India, and China. The study compared medical costs, the health status of the working-age population, and the relationship between the two in a systematic way, in essence identifying the bang for the buck. It's not surprising that the U.S. was worse than the G5 countries, but the U.S. is worse than the industrializing nations as well. Health that is worse for each dollar spent. The Business Roundtable has a particular worry in this regard, and it's not humanitarian. It's worried about the excessive cost and poor outcomes of our medical care system because of its effect on U.S. competitiveness in the global market. It would be one thing to have expensive medical care that keeps American workers highly productive. It's quite another to have expensive medical care that results in lowered productivity compared to global competitors because of on-the-job injuries, medical mistakes, shortened lifespans, and other medical failures. for a real economic solution, one only needs to turn to the analysis of the HR 676 single-payer plan by the Institute for Health and Socioeconomic Policy. The Institute is the research arm of the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee. Their report is subtitled, An Economic Stimulus Plan for the Nation, because while total medical care costs would increase, that cost would be almost totally covered by increased taxes from the growth in business activity and the over 2 million jobs that would be created by a single-payer system. These are net jobs, by the way, jobs after you account for the jobs that would be lost when the medical insurance industry disappears. One of the conservative assumptions made in this study is that utilization of medical services would remain about the same after a single-payer system goes into effect. What the Business Roundtable study suggests is that average utilization is likely to go down for a wide variety of reasons. Obvious examples come to mind. People without insurance won't wait until they're on death's door before getting medical care. Less obvious examples include the reduction in stress-related illness that results from increased medical and with it financial security. Instead of this, we're treated to the promotion of the so-called Massachusetts plan, which essentially punishes people who can't afford insurance, delivers care that is worse than before its implementation, and has costs still escalating so seriously that the governor of Massachusetts is threatening to cut payments to hospitals and providers. However, the Massachusetts plan has the virtue of keeping insurance companies fat. Why are Max Baucus and Barack Obama clinging to this corpse? In Senator Baucus's case, David Himmelstein of the Physicians for a National Health Program suggests an obvious answer: the huge campaign contributions made by the insurance industry. But there also seems to be more to it than that. Based on his experience promoting the single-payer study by the Institute for Health and Socioeconomic Policy through the halls of Congress, Michael Leidy witnessed an almost irrational fear of single-payer. In other words, ideology is at work, even among business groups that would benefit. Barack Obama is another matter. Not long ago, as an Illinois state senator, he publicly endorsed single-payer. Now, he's on the table clinging to a corpse. Whether he's been corrupted, gone mad, making a stupid political calculation, or strategically provoking us to force him to do what's right, what we need to do is plain to see. Put single payer on the table, get up there with it, and don't get off until we get what we need. In addition to the website for HR 676, a focal point for this campaign is the website singlepayeraction.org, where you'll be able to sign a petition demanding single payer now and find information about the single payer movement. We have a link on our website, as well as a link to the site for Physicians for a National Health Program. And somebody, please call the morgue to get the corpse of our current medical insurance system off the table. It's stinking up the place. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Now to our topic and our guest. The show is Regulating Wireless Radiation, and our guest is Cindy Sage, who is owner of Sage Associates, a nationally renowned environmental land use consulting firm specializing in the assessment of factors that affect the suitability of land for conservation and for development. She's an expert in translating complex technical and scientific information for the public and decision makers. Her specialty area of practice is the effect of electromagnetic fields. She provides environmental monitoring, EMF site assessment, and EMF policy evaluations for electric transmission line and wireless antenna cell tower projects. She is a founding member of the Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara. Ms. Sage was one of the first faculty in the Environmental Studies program at UC Santa Barbara and developed and taught classes there. She was appointed by the Governor of California to the Board of Registration for Professional Engineers, and she is the co-author with David Carpenter, of the Bioinitiative Report, a collection of 14 scientific papers by global researchers and public policymakers with their suggestions for allowable limits for wireless exposures. So welcome back.
Hello, Lena. It's so nice to be back.
It's always so nice to have you. It's always a relief. It's sort of like a little spot of sanity.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. You know, there's been a lot of movement in the last year and in the last few months in particular, which I'd love to share with you today.
Well, why don't we start with talking about the big news of this publication of a paper that you and David Carpenter wrote that's been published in the journal Pathophysiology.
Pathophysiology, right. And it's not just a chapter that David Carpenter and I have co-authored, but it is, I think, a journal that will have 15 individual chapters by some of the world's leading scientists on electromagnetic fields and radio frequency radiation health effects. In fact, just as a little bit of history, Lena, on this, you know, 2 years ago, we published the Bioinitiative Report. Many of the same scientists originally did their work for the Bioinitiative Report, but we did something fairly unusual. We didn't go through the normal scientific process to put it into a peer-reviewed journal where, you know, only scientists would see it. We put it out on the web, and overnight everyone in the world with an internet connection had access to it. And for that, over the last year and a half, we've had some criticism that, well, you know, it was a really good science and public health report, but, you know, how good was it if it wasn't peer-reviewed? So the real importance of this publication of literally almost all of the Bioinitiative chapters updated and a few new ones is that this pathophysiology journal is peer-reviewed, and now this science that we have been trying to bring to public attention is really going to stand on its own.
What's been the response?
Well, it's the individual chapters now are just going up online under the pathophysiology website. Online publication is sort of pre-publication, and so they're slipping in one by one there as you check each day. The actual print journal itself will not be out for a few more weeks. So I think we're going to see a sort of a rolling wave of interest in this. But I can tell you that overnight, after the release of a little press notice on this, this was front page news in about 13 Canadian papers. They picked it up very quickly. And we're now seeing it, their press release has been translated into Japanese and Portuguese and Spanish and French and so on. So I think in the next week we'll see this go around the world and we'll see people beginning to register their interest in what this science has to say. But so far we're very, very pleased.
Traditionally, especially using the Bioinitiative Report as a model, your work has been very well received in Europe. The EU Parliament, for instance, has come out with a whole discussion and suggestions about what to do.
Well, I have to tell you, it was just gratifying and astonishing to all of us at the Bioinitiative Working Group that the European Parliament last September took the Bioinitiative Report as the basis for a recommendation that was adopted. I think the vote was 522-16 to include a very strong urging to the governments there to look at the adequacy of their existing public safety limits for radio frequency radiation for cell phones and electromagnetic fields from power lines and to come up with some new guidelines or new limits, because they're recognizing in the European Union countries that they have a public health issue that's growing larger every day. And this advice was forwarded on to amend their cancer action plan in the European Union. And then we haven't talked about this, but just a couple of weeks ago, one of the major parliament committees on environment reviewed this recommendation in detail and again adopted, I think, a 43-1 vote to adopt and forward very strong recommendations to bring the issue before the Parliament and the member countries. So over there, things are happening almost on a daily basis that show recognition of the issues and the public health consequences of not taking action. in contrast to the United States, where it's still very quiet.
It's so quiet that it's actually extremely rare and very odd for me when somebody has a clue that there's anything wrong with these technologies. I was, I confess, I was looking to grow brain cells in front of the television last night, and there was a program that was a new one that I was curious about. And I was getting up and walking around the house during the commercials, and I happened to notice that there was an extraordinary number of commercials about wireless, exclaiming that you should have everything wireless in your life, that you should experience everything that you do, whether you're on trips or anything else, and send it, not just be there and enjoy yourself, but to record it and to film it and to do all these things with it, with your technology.
And to send it
before you even get back. And there's lots of scenes of children, texting and making jokes with their dad about how they're... And it was that, along with the drug commercials, which talk about the benefits of taking a drug and then tell you that it's going to probably cause advanced liver disease and blindness and suicide and things like that. I was, I just lost hope.
Well,
but then I remembered that's not everybody.
I was going to save my lemon award for last, but something that came across my desk today was an announcement of blanket wireless coverage for dementia patients. Have you seen this?
No.
Yeah, it's the idea that we can let dementia patients live longer in their homes if we simply blanket their living environment with wireless, so we can keep an eye on them and have electronic reminders about take your pill now, that kind of please eat, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but they won't even able to respond to that if you blanket them in wireless.
Well, the point is that this kind of wireless coverage is probably going to drive them further into forgetfulness, disorientation, and falls. And falls are one of the leading causes of eventual death in the elderly.
Yes.
So this kind of nonsense, the development of applications of wireless technologies where they have no place going for health is really something that we try to call out. It's an everyday occurrence to see another application that is just nonsense in terms of creating yet another layer of radio frequency that is going to have health consequences.
Well, there are two things that this leads us into, but I think what we ought to go to immediately is, why don't you just go ahead and unpack why it is that you're concerned about dementia patients and wireless? Why don't you talk about the documented health effects on the brain of exposure to very low levels of radiation like you get when you're exposed to wireless?
Well, the first thing to say for people to give this context for the discussion is that, the current limits for radio frequency radiation and microwave exposures for whole body, and that's what we talk about when we're talking about putting wireless into someone's environment, are actually very high, but they're based on old and obsolete thinking about what affects the body. And today we know, based on thousands of studies, that effects on the body and on the brain and on brain function and cognition are happening at levels that are hundreds or thousands of times lower than the standards allow. So we can be in compliance in these environments with safety standards, but that doesn't mean that they are safe, and in fact they are not safe. If you look at the pathophysiology chapters that are, again, just out today, which probably represent the best compendium of the studies that we're relying on to make these judgments, you will see that there are EMF effects on the brain in at least four of the major publications of the 14 or 15 in this journal. And they report effects on well-being and mental functioning primarily. If you look at the studies that are discussed in Michael Kundi's chapter, you see that there are a handful of studies that talk about neuropsychiatric complaints in people who live near cell sites, and that is the most studied situation. These are wireless antenna sites, the poles that have the antennas on them that transmit wireless communications, voice communications and data transmission for your cell phones and iPhones and Blackberries.
Well, and Wi-Fi and broadband and Wi-Fi too.
Well, just talking about the studies, what we know from those is that neuropsychiatric complaints go way up, and they include headache, loss of concentration and attention, which is vital for learning. They document memory loss, dizziness, tremors, depressive symptoms, and very significantly sleep disturbance, among others. So what we know today is that these very low-level exposures, if chronic, are directly related to changes in brainwave activity, brain function, concentration, memory, attention, sleep, behavior, and other measures of well-being. And if they go on for a long time, there is some indication in these studies that it may lead to cancer mm-hmm. and neurological diseases. Mm-hmm. So we have enough evidence today, if not proof, we have enough evidence to say, look, we really can't go on deploying and rolling out technologies and new applications of these technologies until someone sits down and says, we have to reevaluate this. Biological effects occur, adverse health effects are occurring, these new technologies are risky, and they're particularly risky for children.
Very much so. The most common thing that I hear with children is sudden behavioral changes and extreme, you know, tantrums and anxiety and things like that. And among people who call me to make an appointment, I hear anxiety disorders and sleep disorders and people saying the most common comment is, I can't turn my brain off.
Right.
And some people enjoy the sort of wired feeling of it, so they will make certain adjustments so that they can actually sleep and stuff, or they'll even take medications because they don't realize, even though they've maybe heard some of these shows, they don't realize that the problem isn't just what's happening to you now. It's, as you just said, it's the downstream effects. You're having some small symptoms now. It means that there are changes taking place in the way that your body functions.
Yeah. Well, listen, human beings and you know, other living beings are meant to cycle day to night, circadian rhythms. You have what's called an arousal cycle, and then you have a rest cycle, and your body needs this kind of, you know, dualism back and forth. You know, we even have studies, Lena, that show that if you put people in relatively high field environments for radio frequency near a cell tower, for example, it speeds the brain and it makes them a little smarter. It makes them do a little better on tests for the immediate moment. But think about what happens if you continue to stimulate and then overstimulate and then never give that central nervous system and its related, you know, abilities to function any kind of rest. It's going to crash. You are going to fall down, and that's exactly what happens. So, you know, we do not yet know everything that we would like to know about these exposures, but what we have today would suggest that chronic exposure to fields that are even, you know, certainly a few microwatts per centimeter squared and probably even a few hundredths of a microwatt per centimeter squared, if chronic, are going to be a concern for health risks.
And what are people being exposed to in urban environments?
Well, it's highly variable. A lot of people, you know, when I give a lecture, a presentation on this, they throw their hands up and say, well, it's everywhere, you know, what can I do? But in fact, it's really not. It's highly variable depending on where you are.
I can attest to that.
You know, line of sight is important when you're near a radio frequency transmitter. Line of sight is important, and if you're in the main beam at equal elevation, then you're going to have a relatively higher exposure than if you're behind a big screen of vegetation, for example, or you'll have none if you're behind a hill.
Or if you fight the installation of a tower near you, as we
well,
did here.
We know that people today, almost everywhere, once they do a little reading, recognize that these don't belong near schools, hospitals, they don't belong near residences, they don't
right.
belong near places where children congregate, and they don't belong, you know, in outdoor environments where we have wildlife sanctuaries.
Yes.
Because as the Pathophysiology Journal introduces, that for the first time, we have a highly regarded wildlife biologist from Spain by the name of Alfonso Balmori, who does, you know, a good and a frightening job of recounting effects on wildlife, waterfowl, and plants.
Well, particularly migratory birds.
particularly migratory birds. And, you know, to me, he's a wonder. Because he's given us great data on tomato plants, for example.
Oh, my.
If you put a tomato plant in front of a cell site, it creates heat shock protein in the plant tissue. Now, that pretty well, you know, tomato plants don't imagine symptoms, and a lot of the very poor treatment by the medical establishment and the research establishment about people who claim to be electrically sensitive, you know, comes around to it's all in your head or you're imagining it. Well, tomato plants don't imagine it, and heat shock protein that's generated is an absolute biomarker of cellular distress. It happens in people, in animals, and in plants.
So it's measurable in the plants.
It's measurable, yeah. So we thank Dr. Balmori for that.
You know, one of the things that I read in the article, because Jeffrey was able to figure out a way to get a full copy of the article, and it talks about the disturbance in the melatonin pathways, and that not only distress, you know, you talk about the sleep, it screws up the circadian rhythms, but it also makes it more likely that you will get cancer.
Yeah. Now, if you take a look in this pathophysiology or in the bioinitiative at the articles on genotoxicity, what you will find is that more than one author is now saying, look, of course we have a mechanism, a plausible biological mechanism, because, you know, this is the kind of exposure that creates free radicals that create oxidative damage to DNA. And if you either and lowered melatonin in many of the studies, so and lowered tamoxifen effectiveness with exposure to EMF. So this melatonin mechanism, of course, is one of the primary mechanisms that people think is operative. But there's another you may have seen go by recently where a very good research paper has shown actually a genetic predisposition to the development of leukemia in children.
Oh, yes, certainly.
And what it means is that there are probably multiple mechanisms at work, but this particular one for leukemia is actually a quadrupling of risk for kids living within about 300 feet of power lines because they have a defective gene and their DNA does not repair. Everybody's DNA breaks all day long, and your body repairs a certain amount of it, and a certain amount doesn't get repaired. But if you start fooling around and disabling genes that do repair work, that's a very serious problem for chronic, long-term neurological disease and for cancer.
So we know for certain that children are at risk because of the developing brain and their ages and the tissues and the whole thing. I mean, we know from the studies and the mechanisms that happen with the damage, but then we also have prenatal exposure and fetal brain development. Might it also be a good time to talk about where people are getting exposed, where they might not expect to be?
You know, it would, and we have just put out a new sort of an outline presentation at our website, Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Nancy Evans and I chair the EMF, CHE EMF committee there, and we have done a little paper that is posted at www.healthandenvironment.org. Perhaps we can provide that later, but the Collaborative for Health and the Environment EMF group now has a paper up which gives all the common sources in daily life for electromagnetic fields and radio frequency radiation. Many of these things people won't even know about. And then it gives solutions or alternatives.
We can link to that on our website.
Yeah, it's a terrific little piece of work. And, for example, a lot of people don't know that when you go in and out of the front door of a department store, those white panels that stand as tall as you are, and they're, you know, 6 or 8 inches wide, as you go in and out, are their security gates. And they produce a very, very, very strong radio frequency field. Very strong. In fact, strong enough to interfere with pacemakers. And so this is an exposure you might not think about. And if you're in and out of a store, if you're Christmas shopping or, you know, doing a week's worth of shopping in one day, you and your child in your arms may be going in and out of some very strong exposures you didn't know were there.
And that's, you know, ladled on top of the citywide Wi-Fi that many cities have and the various antennas and all the rest of it.
It's another layer. Anyway, this is a good source to look at exposures, where they occur in daily life, and how you can identify them, and then, you know, for some of the personal things you might be putting into your life that have a wireless component, how to recognize that and avoid it, because they're certainly excellent choices. One other thing I wanted to point out while we're talking about the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, which is just a wonderful organization that's meant to disseminate high-quality science and public health information for people who are interested. Nancy Evans and I and a couple of other people have authored a radiation fact sheet. It was actually done for the President's Cancer Panel hearings in January in Phoenix. And that radiation fact sheet is downloadable as a PDF on, again, the same website, www.healthandenvironment.org. And it covers low-dose non-ionizing radiation. I'm sorry, it covers low-dose ionizing radiation, for example, mammography radiation, CT scans, and other things.
CT is not low-dose.
Yeah, and it also, well, it alerts
it
people.
Right.
And it also covers non-ionizing radiation, EMF, and radio frequency,
yeah,
with specific recommendations for what this country and its government agencies ought to be doing.
Yes.
About it.
Yeah. So we'll link to those on the website. We need to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're interviewing Cindy Sage about the new possible regulating, well, hopefully regulating wireless radiation. So stay with us. We'll be back after this. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're interviewing Cindy Sage about regulating wireless radiation. If you missed parts of today, you can listen to a free stream on our website all week long at yourownhealthandfitness.org. We'll also have links that were mentioned during this show. CD copies are available, lots more, all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772.
Can I tell you a joke?
Please. Oh, gosh, yes.
Can I tell you a joke?
Certainly.
To lighten this subject up just a little bit, Martin Blank, who is the editor of he was our meta-editor on this Pathophysiology Journal. He was the cracker of the whip to get us all to do our work. And he wrote the preface, and it starts out, "There is an old joke with a well-known punchline about a man who has just fallen from the 86th floor of the Empire State Building in New York. As he passes the 30th floor, he is heard saying to himself, 'Well, so far, so good.'"
yes.
And Martin goes on to say, "Overall, the scientific evidence shows the health risk is significant, and to deny it is like being in free fall and thinking, 'Well, so far, so good.'"
Well, that is very human nature to do that too. So I'm okay now. Okay,
yeah.
Now, where will people, if they want to get hold of this journal, since it's kind of a scholarly thing, how do people get hold of the journal if they want to get the whole, because it sounds like there's more than just your article in there that's worth looking at.
There are a couple of ways to do it. When the print version is out in a few weeks, it can be purchased. I don't have a price yet on it. And the individual chapters are given to each of the authors in a PDF format. So at a minimum, you could contact the authors and ask that they send you a copy of their own article, you know, their own chapter. The articles are for sale on the pathophysiology website today, but it's a little pricey. I think it's $32 per article to download them in a PDF, but certainly people are able to do that immediately if they want to.
Well, and they also might find that just going to the bioinitiative.org website, that they, if they look at that material, it's very close. I mean, what you've done is an update. And
yeah,
that
would be a good starter, and of course that's free. It's always been free.
Exactly.
The pathophysiology does have the journal has an article on fertility, which I think is very important, and an article on wildlife, which is very important. So there are a few new things.
Yes.
But I think that most scientists are more than willing, if you ask them politely, to send you copies of their papers. So it should be available soon.
There's another resource that most people have access to, which is either a college or university library, most of which should be able to either carry it or have an online resource for these for the journal. And most public universities and colleges will give access to people to find things and
good. We hope they. Hi, Jeff. We hope they go out widely. But it's like newspapers are disappearing because people get everything free on the internet. You know, these good science journals, you know, have to cover their costs. So I don't want to indicate that. You know, we wouldn't like to see them get paid for their work here, but we also want to see the information out.
Let's switch gears slightly and talk about the current political atmosphere currently surrounding this issue. One thing to talk about is Kucinich, what he's been doing.
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich, in his role in Congress, he organized and held the very first congressional hearings last September and brought in Ron Herbermann, David Carpenter, and others to testify about what we think the public health implications are for wireless technologies. And then, of course, a member of the FCC was there and the American Cancer Society saying no problem, or we don't recognize the problem yet. And then, of course, Ellen Marks, who testified on behalf of her husband, Alan Marks, who has a malignant brain tumor, which he believes was related to very, very heavy cell phone use in his occupation. So that was the first go-round, and I understand that we may be scheduling a congressional staff briefing in Washington with the help of Kucinich's office on April 13th of this year. So, things are moving along, but I have to tell you, we feel absolutely swamped in looking at the stimulus package that's also a topic of big conversation in Congress, that is offering up billions of dollars to install wireless broadband over power line and a major wireless rollout as part of the broadband initiative, which is a terrible idea. And we cannot understand how Obama's advisors are simply clueless on health effects. There seems to be absolutely no discussion about this.
Well, and in fact, there's some meetings scheduled about the Broadband Technology Opportunities Program, and the public can attend and advocate for alternative technologies, which we'll talk about as soon as I give this information out. But there's been no notice at all anywhere in the media or anywhere. And the only way that we found out about it is that there are a lot of activists, you know, like you and I and other people who have been digging around, who uncovered this information and started passing it around, and everybody's passing it around. And we'll have something, won't we, this afternoon? We'll have something on our website that people can click on that will open a rather long document that is saying, please forward urgent action. And there are these meetings that are going to be happening very soon, in the next week here, and they're happening in three different locations, and it's difficult to find exactly where they are, but it's possible. There is a PDF link on one of them that does work.
Mm-hmm.
And we're urging people very strongly to go and check on this information, sign all the petitions that are possible for you to sign, and if possible, go. I think the closest to us here would be Las Vegas, but there are people all over the country listening to the show. Jeffrey, you had a comment.
Well, it's also possible to, and we'll have a link to this, to submit comments to the agencies that are responsible for this broadband. I forget the exact name of it, but it's, you know, very grand.
Broadband technology opportunities.
Cover the world with wireless.
No, it doesn't say anything about wireless, just a broadband technology opportunities program.
But you have an opportunity to submit comments before April 13th.
Good. Well, you know, you're doing a tremendous public service to alert people and then tell them what to do. Because, you know, a broadband rollout, if it's fiber optic and cable, is wonderful. You know, we think everybody ought to be able to log on to the Internet. What we don't want to see is this involuntary exposure for everyone to wireless, whether or not you want to access the Internet that way. You cannot opt out because this is in the airway. This is
You can't close your door.
This is in the air.
Can't close your door. Can't close your windows.
Yeah, it comes right through the door. And broadband over power line, BPL, I don't want that to get lost as an idea because that is a truly horrendous technology where your broadband signal comes in and uses your current electrical wiring in your home, which is unshielded for radio frequency, to actually bring in your signal. So you're radiating radio frequency throughout your house, and you're paying for that wonderful service by buying a little black box to let you decode it. But even if you don't want it, you just don't buy the black box, but you still have that involuntary exposure, and the industry makes a profit on it. And, again, this is just a very poor idea that will result ultimately in health costs that this country can't afford today. So
it's also obscene that this industry is getting away, I can say this, I think, with murder. I mean, it's very much like the cigarette debacle. It's going to take a long time before this is well known. I mean, as you say, you know, people often misunderstand that Jeffrey and I are Luddites, and we are certainly not. Here we are in the radio, you know, and radio is another exposure.
And radio does have its own, emissions.
If you're living near,
consequences,
yeah, if you're living near a transmitter, that's never good. And in addition, you know, we use a lot of equipment. I mean, my office is packed with equipment, and I'm on the Internet all the time, and I use high-speed Internet, and I use it on a cable, and it is faster and more secure. I mean, we've actually been given information by people who are technoids that there are ways for us, for instance, to get into other people's you can get into other people's accounts when they're wireless.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know.
I have to tell you, I went back to New York a couple of weeks ago to give a deposition, and I stayed at the Waldorf Astoria. Do you know why? Because it doesn't have wireless.
Oh,
it's
I have to write that down.
Few hotels in the world.
Which one?
The Waldorf Astoria.
The Waldorf. You just have to start saving now.
Lovely. No, actually, it was a very budget-priced room in a very beautiful hotel.
I'm there.
But they don't have wireless, and the reason they say they don't is that they are so concerned about their international clientele and the security of their Internet communication.
Oh, we have to get that out more.
Diplomats and dignitaries come over here, and they stay there, and they don't want to have eavesdropping concerns. If you want wireless, you go down to the lobby, and there's a little room you can go into. But it's a very civilized approach to providing the service without providing the sleepless night. Yeah. You know, Lena, just in contrast to the good job Kucinich and a few are doing here in this country, I wanted to just highlight a couple of recent things in Europe that have been remarkable.
Please.
In Liechtenstein, which is, I know, a tiny country, but they have followed the lead of the bioinitiative recommendations, and they have adopted, as a country, some very, very, very low limits for wireless. And we applaud them for that. And following shortly after that, in Belgium, the Belgian constitutional court system ruled in an appellate proceeding that cities can choose what limits they want, and they are not bound by what are called the ICNIRP standards, which are the current, you know, 1,000-time-too-high standards. So they're, you know, in Belgium now looking at a 4 volts per meter limit. That's an electric field limit. That's the metric. But it's about 40 times lower than the old limit. So we've now seen two countries go for lower limits, I mean, officially. And in France, the big news there is that appellate courts have been requiring the demolition of existing cell towers based on precautionary planning, again, based on health effects documented in the Bioinitiative report and others like it. So in France, their solution is don't put them up, tear them down where they're poorly located, and educate the public strongly that children should not use cell phones at all, and ban advertising of cell phones to children. So these are all moves now that countries are taking because they don't want to participate in the negligence of continued rollouts where they know these health effects are going to come.
There have been a few things happening around here, too. Southern California, city of Glendale, put a moratorium on towers. And there's some groups forming in Southern California that are very strong. And there are lots of petitions circulating. There's one on our website now that we're going to put up there. There's the EMR Policy Institute has one too, right, Cindy?
I know of two excellent petitions. One is the EMR Policy Institute, which essentially says adopt the Bioinitiative recommendations. And the other is a newer group that I'm not real familiar with, but Doug Loringer has been,
yeah, but he hasn't put the petition up yet.
Yeah.
But that will be on
yeah,
our website yeah. when it's out. We'll probably have Doug on.
Yeah, well, for the first time in probably 10 years, I can say that we are seeing coalitions of local community groups who have fought cell towers or who have lobbied school districts not to put in Wi-Fi.
Oh, well, we have a couple of small, I think people know that we fought for 10 months. I mean, it just was this, I almost lost my mind. It was so hard to organize our little community in the woods here in West Sonoma County to resist putting a cell tower very close to homes in the woods on a migratory bird path next to our water tower. And
well, you're doing the work that government should do.
Well, but the point I'm trying to make is it's achievable for people. If they get organized and get busy, and if they need help, they can get in contact with us if they're fighting something.
Good.
But we also had somebody contact us in the 11th hour, which is the Ecology House, which is the only government-subsidized housing for people with chemical sensitivity, people who are disabled from environmental sensitivities. And they were going to put the antennas on the power line thing, like you were just talking about, near them. And a bunch of us organized and got busy and wrote letters, and we backed them down, and we don't know if it's permanent, but we backed them down. So it is possible to make a lot of noise. It's just that as soon as you get wind of something, you have to act very fast and very aggressively. Let me just let you know, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett is with me, and we're talking to Cindy Sage about regulation of wireless radiation. You had something more, I think, you were going to say, Cindy?
Well, you know, the kind of conversations that you have been able to support with this reporting, and I know my first program, I think, Lena, for you was all the way back in 1998. It may have even been earlier than that, but it has literally taken this long for good enough science, good enough evidence to be made available for everyone to take to their decision makers, and for people who have a family interest or a community interest in this to develop the maturity of approach to understand how to take this now before decision makers. And it's gratifying, and I think you've had a large part in bringing public awareness to the issue. But there is so much more to do, and I am hopeful that our part in this is not advocacy, but it's providing information that people then can, you know, then take out and use. But, you know, local politics is important, but we really hope people will understand that you've got to take it all the way to Washington, and it's very important now that we have a new president with an open mind about so many things, to get a good hearing of this evidence and to be very vocal about promoting it. Because when you understand that just the use of a cell phone by a pregnant woman, a mother-to-be, can evidently affect the fetal brain development of that baby growing inside of her, and with with cell phone use during pregnancy can produce a child with behavioral problems by the time that child is in grade school is so worrisome. This is an impact on the future generation, not just the human genome, but also our ability to think, our ability to reason and exercise judgment. And in civilized societies, these are the most fundamental things that we have that carry a society forward to be successful. So you can't underestimate the fact that we need this information to get to the decision makers in a way that makes sense, whatever that communication is. And it's going to take great determination, I think, to do this.
You have recommendations. This technology is so out of the box. I mean, people are not going to go back to not having it. They're going to use this no matter what because it's just it's too much. You know, people like it too much. It's too much fun. So you have...
And
you
it may
have,
even be addictive.
Oh, no. I think that that's clear, that it stimulates the dopamine receptors and causes an addictive response. And if you watch people's behaviors, you can see that it's addictive.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You know, when you read all the press about Blackberries and Trios and, you know, the addictive behavior, you know, we have a language now for it, Crackberries. But it isn't very funny if it turns out to be physiologically addictive, meaning it's not just a social phenomenon. And if so, then cell phones are nothing more than drug delivery devices.
Well, and Trios and Blackberries even more. Mm-hmm.
And if that's so, then we have no business giving our kids cigarettes. We have no business giving our kids alcohol. We have no business giving our kids cell phones or other wireless devices or exposures that trigger, these kinds of behaviors. This is so fundamental to the discussion that, you know, we hope people hear this. And if there's some doubt in your mind about giving your 8-year-old or 9-year-old or 10-year-old a cell phone for, quote, safety reasons, the biggest safety reason is not to do this is that you're looking at downstream health effects that are going to dwarf, you know, whether or not they get home by 3 o'clock.
Well, people have completely forgotten about wired phones. I mean, it's you know, I had a person that lives out here being concerned about cell phone coverage, which incidentally we have from a tower that's 5 miles from us. We have good cell phone coverage for one company, but it's 5 miles away. So we don't need them to be next to our houses. But she said that she was worried about being on the road and having her car break down. And I said, well, you know, 10 years ago, if that happened, you got out of your car and sort of flagged people down. And somebody
would come by
or something. I mean, I said, why do you live here if you're so afraid to live here? I mean, it's yeah. What do you think we did? I mean, my car broke down on the Nimitz at 11 o'clock at night in Oakland, and somebody came by and helped me. And, I mean, it's not,
yeah.
you know. So,
yeah. Well, you know,
but wait, but before we run out of time, I want you to give me your vision of what the world. You're a scientist. You love technology too. So what's your vision? What's the right? This we know the wrong way.
Yeah.
What's the way?
I want everyone's home to be something like a tenth of a nanowatt per centimeter squared.
No, but tell me how this would be achieved. Give us some idea of what you're.
We don't need wireless inside our homes. And when you put wireless inside your home, you're affecting other homes around you. So
350 feet. Yes.
Yeah. Don't be a bad neighbor. Neighborhoods and schools and places that people live and need to sleep or need to relax, need time away from work, no wireless. Just we don't need wireless.
So tell us what the options are.
We have cable modem. We have, you know, fiber optic systems to bring us all of the connections that we need with shielded cable. So there's no radio frequency exposure. We also need people to live away from power lines, whether they're distribution with high loading or transmission lines. We need big setbacks from those because the evidence is so clear for Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases now. We need, in particular, our schools to be zones of quiet, harmonious learning for kids where the exposures from wireless are absent so they can think, so they can concentrate, and they can learn. And the financial benefits will come rolling right back to us if we make those choices. I think that if people really understood, even in sending kids to college, you send a child to college today, and if they live in a dorm, you can't even use a cordless phone because there's so much radio frequency radiation pollution in the air, they have to use cell phones. I think that we ought not to have any kind of wireless in living environments for students of any age. And, you know, you really, it's an upslope battle here because I don't think pregnant women ought to live in environments that expose them or work in environments that expose them to these emissions. So once you take this into the workplace, unless you ban pregnant women from the workplace, you've got to provide clean, quiet, non-wireless environments, non-EMF environments for them as well.
Yeah, ironically, office environments are perfect for wired. I mean, you're sitting at your desk. You're not sitting in the backyard.
So once you start thinking down this road, where is that we really need it? And, you know, I just think that we have to rethink the entire infrastructure that we intend to build for the long term if we want to minimize the do-over costs when we figure out wireless was a really bad choice, and also if we want to avoid the health costs down the road, which are sure to come and which we can't afford.
Cindy, before you go, people are very confused about wireless headsets. I've said wired headsets, not wireless headsets. And they're also very much in love with these new phones, you know, that are a mixture of a BlackBerry and a Trio and a phone, like the iPhone, and other companies are jumping on board. I'd like you to go ahead and remind people of what the problem is with these new phones and with these wireless headsets.
Yeah. Well, nothing I say is going to create a safe phone. So you can reduce your exposures, you know, with a number of techniques. But, again, nothing is going to reduce your exposure enough to make, you know, the bio effects, you know, go away. But don't wear it on your body when it's on. Either turn it off or keep it away from your body because the emissions are very strong.
Well, but haven't we just increased the emissions tenfold by creating these phones that are now small computers?
Yeah. Yeah, the PDAs, personal digital assistants, are massively more powerful than the old cell phones or old cordless phones. So keep them away from your body. Don't wear them when they're on. Use a wired headset. It's good to use one that has the hollow cord from the ear down to the shoulder in particular. We don't recommend wireless Bluetooth-type headsets because you can't really tell whether you're buying one that is on and radiating all the time at some low level. And so by the time you've had 8 or 10 hours during a day, you've got a cumulative dose that, again, is still huge. Go back to corded phones at home and at the office. Really minimize adult use of cell and cordless phones, and don't let kids use them at all.
Right. You just mentioned cordless phones. Remind people of that as well.
Yeah, the brain tumor risks for malignant brain tumors and acoustic neuromas, auditory tumor, are about equivalent for cordless phones and cell phones. Cell phones have gotten so powerful today that they're probably as dangerous as cell phones are, so you need to think of them both as dangerous and avoid excessive or unnecessary usage of both.
Yeah, my comment is I am astonished when I'm walking in cities and I see people on cell phones because I occasionally see people on Bluetooth wireless.
With the Borg light.
But I never see people on phones that have wired headsets, ever. Mostly what I see is people with a phone attached to their head, holding it against their face. It's amazing.
Yeah. One more thing. Have you ever seen somebody crunch a cell phone to their shoulder, you know, to hold it so they can do something else with their hands?
Yeah.
You tremendously increase the amount of radiation into your head that way. Do not do that ever. That's not one of the ways in which they were rated for their specific absorption rate.
Oh, that's good.
You don't want to do that either. And you don't want to use them out where you have a very weak signal because it's making the phone work a lot harder and putting a lot more radiation into your head. So ironically, you want to be near a cell site if you're going to use that phone.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to let you go, but it's certainly not going to be the last time you're on the show. So thank you so hard for all your hard work, Cindy Sage. We will have lots of links to all of the things that we talked about this afternoon at some point when Jeffrey can get them up there. Again, Cindy Sage, thank you so much for your work.
You're doing good work, Lena and Jeff. Thanks so much.
Okay. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, how to get CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom. And remember to go to the website for links that we described during the show today.